Welcome back to Mound Money. On the phone with us now, we have David Benjamin. He and his co-author, David Komlos, are the authors of a book titled Cracking Complexity, The Breakthrough Formula for Solving Just About Anything Fast. David, thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, let me start off in the tease before the break. I talked about in business, we're often faced with complicated and complex projects. What's the difference between complicated and complex, and why is that important?
So when we think about the difference between the two, we actually use some language from somebody named Dave Snowden, who's big in the complexity realm. And his definitions are the definitions we've adopted. A complicated challenge is one that has been solved many times before. It's fairly mechanistic or technical. And what that means is that there is a step-by-step checklist that can be followed by somebody who knows how to do it, and they can solve that problem time and again using the checklist and their expertise. So, for example, we'd say that fixing a car is a complicated challenge. It's not complex. So complex challenges are categorically different in that there really is no discernible cause and effect. The problem is different each time that you see it. There's lots of interdependencies and moving parts, and they're very hard to detect. So really, to make progress on something complex, you can't just follow a checklist. You can't just bring in an expert. What you need to do is to really get a sense of what's going on, try things, see what works, see what doesn't work, and proceed accordingly.
Although, David, I have to give you a warning. My co-host this morning, Roger, he and his son enjoy turning wrenches and fixing cars. I've heard some of his adventures. He may push back on the complicated but not complex. You gave an example of complicated. Give us an example of a complex project, maybe a company that you've worked with that you can talk about, and give us an example of a complex situation.
Sure. I probably can't name names, but we've been involved often with leaders who are dealing with a post-merger integration, for example, where what they hoped to gain from the merger isn't materializing, and there's human factors and culture clashes and a lot of false starts in terms of well-intentioned initiatives, or a chip company that's trying to kind of reinvent itself in the marketplace given the technological changes that are going on around it. Or often we're dealing with internal cultural issues, talent, et cetera.
Those kinds of problems, I know for when I've been involved in companies in a post-merger world, and it is almost never what they expected it to be prior to the merger. Historically, how have businesses approached that, and has it been too much like approaching it as a complicated problem rather than a complex problem?
Yeah, exactly. There is a very, very well-understood model. It's gotten a lot of mileage when you're dealing with something that's complicated, and that is to set up what we call a hub-and-spoke model, where the expert or the expert team is set up at the hub, and they basically interview people and find out, you know, what it is they need to know in order to configure the right solution. So that model has been in use for years and years, and leaders have grown up on it in terms of being, whether it's with a traditional management consulting firm or an in-house team, a model that works. But it works when things are complicated. The problem with that model is that when things are complex, the people who are set up at the hub don't know what they don't know. They only get the input from the group of people they're talking to and other research they've done. But they are not the people who are living and breathing the challenge every day, and they are not enough people to really understand all of the moving parts and all of the facets that may be at play in the challenge.
David,
rather than hub and spoke, the model that's needed is many-to-many, everybody connected to everybody else, and it's all the right people. It's not everybody in the organization or the system. It's a representative set that has the right variety.
And how do you do that? Because everyone to everyone, brings in its own complexity. So what's your advice on how to go from hub and spoke to everyone in a way that can still be an understandable and manageable process?
Yeah, and let me just state what you're not stating explicitly, which is there's a lot of ways to have poor experiences trying to connect people many to many. Many of us have been around boardroom tables with 24 leaders, you know, and 3 hours to figure something out, and it's complete chaos because that's the nature of human dynamics. So when you want to solve something big and bring together, let's say, again, 36 people, all of whom have a piece of the puzzle, you have to give them a frame, a method, we would call it a formula, that lets them be very productive with each other. So I can break that down further, but it would include things like behavioral protocols or behavioral roles that people are playing so they're not all talking at once and so that they're forced to listen to each other. And iteration, so several rounds of conversations on any given topic so that people have time to kind of let go of their own biases and beliefs and really hear other people and make the necessary shift in their own perspective. And again, that takes iteration. You don't get people changing opinions after sort of one-hour conversation.
And what about, you know, we're talking about large organizations. I used to work for a Fortune 500 company long, long time ago called DuPont. That's now Dow DuPont. That was a very complicated merger. They're still working through that. And so when you're talking about billions and billions of dollars, you can afford to hire top-tier consultants like yourself to come in and help with the process. We live in Park City. It's a lot of small businesses, a lot of family-run businesses. You know, how do you think about solving a complex problem that maybe is a $100,000 problem as opposed to one that you add 10 or 20s and make it into a $10 million or $100 million problem? How does the small business person deal with complexity?
Yeah, leaders and small business owners, et cetera, have found a lot of traction using, if not the entire formula, elements of the formula. So let me give you an example. One of the key steps in terms of dealing with complexity in the way that we're talking about is to embrace what we call requisite variety, the right variety of people who collectively can figure something out. And if you take the lens of variety very, very seriously, even if you're a small business owner and you're looking for, you know, for example, a decision about whether or not we start to franchise or, you know, what's our growth roadmap look like for the next 3 to 5 years, just because you're small doesn't mean that you don't have good variety, a lot of untapped talent inside your own organization, but also around it. So your customers, your partners, other people in the community, other people with businesses like yours in other communities, all of whom have really interesting perspectives that you probably aren't used to tapping into. Now, if you bring all those people together, if they can give you the time, and have them dealing with a question you give them, like what is the right way to double the business of the skateboard shop over the next 3 years so that, you know, we become number one in the state or whatever that is. Even if you get them together for a very brief time, they will give you perspectives and thoughts and insights and ideas that both reflect your current reality because you've got people who are living that, but also realities of the market, realities of other markets and things that have worked and things that have failed. And you will be amazed, and people tell us they are amazed at how different the thinking is and the relationship they build with those people who then become advocates, helping in whatever ways they can to achieve the goal you've asked them for help on.
So let's take a step back and discuss a little bit about the overview of the formula that the book discusses for solving complex problems. How would you sort of outline the formula in bite-sized morsels?
Well, it all starts with, first of all, acknowledging that you've got something complex in front of you, and it's not just complicated. And so that forces you to shift from who am I going to bring in to figure this out for me to who am I going to engage who can help me and collectively figure this out. So that's that notion of variety. When you bring together high variety groups, whether that's 10 people or 30 people or 50 people, the wrong thing to do is to tell them how to answer your question. So if I step back a moment, one of the other things we talk about is the need to articulate a question that really does a good job of articulating whatever your complex challenge is. So with that question and with the right group of people, the wrong thing to do is to tell them what they need to talk about to answer your question. So another key premise of the formula is that having brought that group together, they should set their own agenda. They should come in with a question, and they should then figure out what it is they need to cover to answer that question. And right from that point on, they've now taken ownership of figuring this out. And that's very, very different from being marched through a preset agenda where, as we say in the book, somebody, a good clerk, a good secretary could probably write the minutes before the meeting happens.
If you're just...
Again, having brought them together, then we talk about the need to fuel their conversations and fuel their progress, both through iteration, as I said once already, but also collisions, really effective collisions that bring everybody in contact with everybody else conversationally in dialogue, to hear each other, to challenge each other, to offer opinions, and to collectively develop the right answers. And that, in a nutshell, is more or less what the formula covers.
Sorry for stepping on you, David. If you're just joining us this morning, our guest is David Benjamin. He and his partner, David Komlos, are the authors of a book called Cracking Complexity, The Breakthrough Formula, Solving Just About Anything Fast. David, my favorite part of your book is the last 20 pages, and we interview authors frequently on this show, and I've never seen the approach that you take in the last 20 pages, which is you walk through each of the steps in your formula, and we want to talk more about those steps. But what I really like is you talk about common problems with each of those steps. Almost, Roger, to use the metaphor of working on a car, you know, you have this symptom going on in the car. Here are three or four solutions for it. It is very hands-on. It is very practical. And like I said, I've never seen that before. So it's certainly worth the price of the book, probably worth 10 times the price of the book, just for the last 20 pages. For instance, you talk about constructing really, really good questions. You talk about why that's important. But one of the challenges, and I think small business owners face this a lot, is you talk about the organization doesn't seem interested in solving the challenge. So you have an owner, they own 100% of the company. You know, the other folks are working on an hourly basis. And how do you get them engaged? How do you solve that problem? So I think it's helpful that you identify it. And then you give some thoughts to how to solve that. What are some of the common problems that you see with small to mid-sized organizations that even though they have the formula, even though they have the framework, what are the typical stumbling blocks? And give us some thoughts on how they can fix those.
Well, in some cases, let me start by saying that conventional thinking, whether you're a leader in a small organization or a large multinational, there's a lot of conventional thinking that forces you or causes you to hold back from really trying to get at your challenge and really trying to get everybody engaged in ownership. Right down to the fact that as a leader, many people feel like it's all on them, that they are a leader of small or large organization exactly because they know how to navigate complex problems. So sort of letting go of that and recognizing that you need help and then asking for that help, it's very, very common for that to be a step that people just aren't ready to take at the beginning. Once they've done the formula before and it's oh, okay, that works, and I know it works, and I'm a good leader for using this approach. I don't have to worry about whether or not I'm admitting some sort of personal failing, then no problem. Now, articulating a question, I'll take that as an example as well. People are very hesitant to be aggressive in their question. It's very easy to make people comfortable and set a target like, let's say, doubling the business or increasing sales by 30%, that is more or less an achievable target, current course and speed. But, you know, the high end or the low end of a great result. So if you set that bar too low, it allows people to give you their ideas and thoughts and recommendations within their understanding of the status quo. If you nudge that goal higher, if you talk about tripling the business, it makes people uncomfortable. It makes the person asking a question a little uncomfortable because they don't want to anger people. But for the people who are being asked to answer it, it really kind of sets a different bar and forces them to think new about what to do. And it's scary. It's scary for people to put down on paper 300% growth when they believe 200% is what's possible. But that's what it takes. And so, again, that would be another example of people sort of holding themselves back from really trying to get at novel solutions.
A few minutes ago, you mentioned the concept of collisions, and it's a concept that's covered in the book. Can you explain what you mean by collisions and why they are an important part of the process?
Yeah, we were actually asked this question recently. Aren't collisions destructive? Do you really mean something destructive here? And we don't. We mean putting people in direct face-to-face contact with each other, giving them a shared context, something that really matters to them, and forcing them into roles as they're discussing that that issue of shared context, where at some points you're forced to listen while other people are talking about it, and at other points you're forced to speak when other people are listening to you. And in other cases, you're forced to offer critique. And, you know, maybe it's your boss who just said something and you're playing a role where you then have to critique what was just said. And so the elements of for example, those protocols, what they're doing is they're creating a new kind of tension. And so it's not the usual interaction. It's people really having frank, passionate conversations with each other for a very short amount of time. I haven't really talked about the speed element here yet, but collisions are finite, they happen, and then people move on. So keeping people moving, keeping them interested, engaged, and passionate, and forcing them to behave in ways that they don't usually behave, we mean all of that when we're talking about collisions.
And you just mentioned a step in the process that we haven't talked about yet. Why don't you go ahead and elaborate on that?
I'm sorry, I'm having trouble hearing you right now.
Sorry. You just mentioned a step in the process that we have not touched on yet. Why don't you go ahead and elaborate on that?
And which step was that?
I'm sorry, I missed the one that you had mentioned, but that's okay. I'll ask a different question. When you're talking to a potential client and you're trying to explain how you and your partner can help them. Oftentimes people will use a story to illustrate the challenge and how you guys have helped, maybe without naming the company, how you have helped that company with that issue. What's your favorite story to use to illustrate that point?
I love the kinds of situations that we set up where we really make people. And again, when I say we, I'm talking about the formula and its use within an organization. But you create a situation where, for example, in a company that, you know, really is not okay with conflict. They've got a harmonious culture and there's a culture of sort of being polite to each other. Setting up situations where you have the CFO and the CEO in the same room, getting into a very passionate debate, even conflict about a really central issue while everyone else is watching. Those kinds of stories happen all the time, and it really has an impact on people when they spend a little bit of time together, 1 or 2 days, in an intense environment where people are really speaking honestly and really genuinely collaborating and co-creating. And so you see behavior that they're not used to. You see the the CEO, who often sort of launches meetings and then tunes out or needs to leave, staying and getting in deep in conversations and playing listening roles while other people are debating something that he or she is passionate about. And just another very quick story that I think was very powerful in terms of this critic role I was talking about a moment ago, where somebody is forced into a role where they have to critique. I was in a session where what was under discussion was something about population health, and it was largely a medical audience. And there was a woman who was forced to play the critic role and listened carefully to what the people who were having a conversation were saying. And then when it was her turn, she offered up an amazing idea. And it just turned everybody's heads, and they thought it was fantastic. And then at the end of the meeting, you could see some of the leaders at the table coming back there and saying, that was an amazing idea. Thank you so much for that. She came to us afterwards and said, funny thing is, I've been saying that same idea for the last 5 years, and nobody's been listening before.
That's funny.
Just happens.
Well, that's a great note for us to end on. And it talks about the importance of having a process and taking the time to do it and focusing on it so everybody in the organization knows we're working on this now, so that that thought that's been shared year after year can germinate and start to take root. David, we thank you for joining us this morning. Our guest has been David Benjamin. He is the author of the book, Cracking Complexity, the Breakthrough Formula for Solving Just About Anything Fast. We didn't get a chance to talk about your use of grammar on the cover, but we enjoyed our conversation. David, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.